All right. I don't know if you're feeling like me, but I hope some of y'all got some coffee this morning, because this kind of weather just makes me want to check out. But this music does not. Man, that was good stuff this morning. That song, that little bit right there, I may be weak, but your spirit's strong in me. My flesh will fail. Man, that is the perfect little sentiment right there for the Sermon on the Mount, which is where we're at. Matthew chapter 5. I think we're going to see a lot of that this morning. I think we're going to see a lot of challenging teaches. Matthew chapter 5. We're continuing our series called The Unexpected Kingdom. This is our study of the Sermon on the Mount, part of a bigger study in the entire book of Matthew, just making our way verse by verse through the book of Matthew. It's kind of how we do things most of the time around here. And so the series is Unexpected Kingdom, how Jesus turns everything upside down and inside out. We've seen a bit over the last few weeks how Jesus turns everything upside down. That's a lot of the Beatitudes and this whole idea that you're envied if you're persecuted, and you're envied and you're blessed and you're happy if you're actually poor in spirit, and if you mourn things that don't make any sense to us. And so we've seen that, but now what we're starting to see is kind of the inside out portion. Jesus is kind of turning some things around for us, and he's helping us understand what was behind the law. That whole Old Testament, the law, the instructions given to us, he's starting to kind of explain that, say, what was the point? And he says he didn't come to abolish it, but instead he came to fulfill it. So what we're looking at is what that means. And so what we see is that the law is a lot more than what meets the eye, and that primarily it's not this checklist faith. And we talk about that a lot around here, but we talk about it a lot because it's so prevalent for so many of us in everything around us. In every other major religion in the world, every other system of belief, and frankly, in most of the system of belief that we grew up in, even if you call it Christianity, it's based on a checklist. If you do certain things, then God will like you and you'll be good before God. If you're able to accomplish certain things, now they're different for every context. For some people it's speaking in tongues, but for other people it's doing your quiet time, and then for other people it's, you know, making sure that you wear a dress to church instead of blue jeans. You know, whatever. Like it's different for every context, but it's still a checklist. You've got certain things that you're expected to do, certain ways that you're expected to be, the to-dos. If your Christian life is a simple to-do list, then you've missed the point. That is not the Christian life. It's really kind of missing the entire point. If that's how you've always tried to live the Christian life, by doing the to-do list, you know, whatever that is, if that's how you've always tried to live the Christian life, then one of three things is probably true of you. And the thing is, I know that it's not a to-do list, but even though I know it's not a to-do list, even though I know that's not how Christianity works and can see that in Scripture, I still revert back to that because it's such a part of what I understood and how I knew Christianity at some point in my life. And I think many of us are in that same place. So one of three things is true of you. One of three things, if you see the Christian life as a to-do list. Either one, you're exhausted. Right? You're exhausted. You're trying your best to live a perfect life at every turn, and you're worried that God will essentially disown you if you fall short at some point. The rules and the to-dos are there for you to earn your favor before God, and so you're doing everything you can, and you are exhausted because you are constantly striving to make God proud, to keep your conscience clean, and somehow that you think if you're just good enough, then God will like you. You look at the Beatitudes back at the beginning of chapter 5, and you see those as kind of entrance requirements for the kingdom of heaven. If you can manage to be all of these things, then just maybe, he'll stamp your passport and he'll let you into heaven at some point. And you're exhausted. Because you're trying everything you can, but you just can't do it. You realize how much the rest of you doesn't want to be those things. And you fight against it constantly, and you're exhausted from trying so hard. So that's one thing that would be true of you. A second thing that might be true of you if you see the Christian life as a to-do list is you're self-righteous. You think that Even though you're not perfect, because nobody's perfect, everybody would say that. So even though you know you're not perfect, you've got a pretty good handle on your spiritual walk. You're fairly disciplined. You've got some verses memorized. You write your check every week. You show up every Sunday. You check your boxes just one after the other. And you think that if the rest of the world, for that matter, just if the rest of the church would just live like you do, things would probably be all right. That if everybody else could just be as good as you are, then we'd be doing fine. And so you've kind of got this attitude that you don't have it all together, but you certainly got it better. You got it together better than most. And so you become this self-righteous person because you can check your box and you can do your to-do list. You're probably a type A type of person because you like to like knock that stuff off. And so that generally can be the category you'll fit in. And this is specifically the person that Jesus is trying to dismantle with the Sermon on the Mount. Specifically the person that he is going after, the Pharisees. But I think we all get challenged at this point. I think on some level, we're all challenged as we go through this. And at some point, there's a hint of self-righteousness in all of us. That we think may not be great, but we're still better than that guy. We're still better than that girl over there. Or the third thing that may be true of you, if you don't fit those other two, either you're exhausted or you're self-righteous, the third thing that may be true of you is you've just quit. You just gave up. You threw your hands up and said, I can't do this. You realize you'll never be any of this stuff. You realize that you're never going to check your boxes, that you're never going to fully complete this list, and you can't do it. You're tired of feeling guilty. For you, Christianity equals guilt. For you, Christianity equals being a guilty person. And so you're tired of that. You've moved on. You just accepted that there's certain things that are going to be true of you and that you're just not going to make it. So you say things like, I can't help my temper. My dad had a temper. My mom had a temper. It's just that kind of Italian blood I got in me. Like, I can't handle that. I'm going to lose my temper. It's just who I am. I can't do anything about that. Or maybe you say something like, I know I'm cynical. I know I grumble and I complain a lot, but if you had my life, if you were here where I'm at, you'd complain too. I can't help my life. It's just the way it is. So I'm going to grumble and I'm going to complain because my life is out of control. And you've just quit. You say, I can't help the way that girls dress and that my eye is drawn to them. That's not my fault. They're wearing the stuff that they're wearing. How am I supposed to keep my mind clean whenever girls are wearing what they're wearing? And I see all that. You know, some of those things become your mantra. It's not my fault. I can't help it. This isn't my thing. Like, I struggle with it, but I can't stop this because there's something outside of me that makes this all happen. I don't have any control over this. So at this point, you're just kind of reserved to the point that life and sin is what it is. It just is what it is. Or maybe you've even taken that next step and you've kind of gotten to the same place that our culture is. Not only are you just reserved to say sin is what it is and I'm going to be what I'm going to be, but instead you're embracing the mantra of the culture and saying, like, I was born this way, right? That's the song. I was born this way. Don't hide yourself in regret. Just love yourself and you're set. So basically what it says is the culture is telling you at every turn, if you feel like you should do it, just do it. The culture's justification for right and wrong is essentially, if you think you should do it and you have the urge to do it, then do it. Desire equals right. That's basically what we're told all over the place. If you have the desire, then it's right for you to have that desire. It's completely logically inconsistent at 1,000 different turns, but for some reason, nobody bothers to stop and say, this makes no sense. I mean, we could go on forever about how this makes no sense and how there's a double standard and how just completely messed up it is. But that doesn't matter because that goes too far. In their mind, it goes too far. It doesn't matter if there's a double standard. What only matters is if you feel like you should do it, then you do it. If you think you should do it, then you're right. We were talking this week in a Bible study. The heart wants what the heart wants, right? You've heard that? So whatever the heart wants is automatically right. The culture's just given up. So where are you on that? Are you exhausted? Are you tired of trying to keep up with all the laws, all the demands, everything that Christianity says you have to do? Are you self-righteous? You feel like you got it all together? You feel like if people were just a little bit more like you, then this world would be a better place? Or have you just given up? And you just said, I am what I am. I am who I am. God made me this way. He's going to have to fix it because I'm defeated. I give up. So where do you fall on that? I think today's text is going to assault all three of those. I think what we're going to see today is that all of these things, and see, here's what's funny about this text. When I first read this text, all three of those things take root in my heart. I feel tired from trying. I feel self-righteous because I'm not as bad as other people that I know, or at least so I think. And then I feel like quitting and just giving up, just saying, look, all of these seem to be prevalent in my heart at the same time whenever I read this. It's amazing how sin works. It's crazy how sin works, and that's what we're going to see this morning. We're going to look at the nature of sin. But even before we begin, let's remember, the very thing Jesus is railing against here is a checklist religion. So if we take the Sermon on the Mount and then make a new checklist out of it, then we've missed the point. He's railing against the checklist religion. Jesus has something greater in mind. The Beatitudes set us up for that, started us off, and then as I said then, and I just want to remind you, this is not entrance requirements for heaven. This is a life that has been changed in the way that those that are in the kingdom live. This is the markers of those that proclaim Jesus as king, not the checklist for those trying to get in. So let's read the text, and then we'll see how it challenges our heart and our faith and then blows up our checklist. Matthew chapter 5, verse 27. You have heard that it was said, you shall not commit adultery. But I say to you that everyone who looks at a woman with lustful intent has already committed adultery with her in his heart. If your right eye causes you to sin, tear it out, throw it away. For it is better that you lose one of your members than that the whole body be thrown into hell. And if your right hand causes you to sin, cut it off and throw it away. For it is better that you lose one of your members than that your whole body go into hell. We'll stop there. That's enough for us this morning. So last week was enough, right? Don't be angry. Not don't murder, but don't be angry. Like Jesus stepping on plenty of toes then. Now he's got to go and he's going to talk about lust and he's going to talk about adultery. So he's just going to kind of continue pressing into our hearts. Nobody's going to escape this teaching. Nobody's going to get away from this. He's just going to keep pressing in. And what I want to do this morning is just what I did last week. Start with some big picture things, big picture ideas, see what Jesus is talking about, and then press in certain ways. He says it's not good enough to say you haven't committed adultery. It's not good enough to say that you haven't committed that act, but you have to guard your eyes too. So he ups the ante just a little bit. He ups the game just a little bit and begins pressing in. And he says, because if you lust after someone, it's the same as if you had already committed the sin. Your body just hasn't had the chance to carry it out. So this is where he sets us up. Man, this teaching is tough. What do you do with this stuff? I mean, he's getting personal on all kinds of levels. What is he doing with this? I mean, who can live up to these things that he's starting to say? Who can get there? But there's a method to what Jesus is doing. He's got something that he wants us to see. And he knows if he presses in and he pushes in, we'll get there. And I want to be clear here. He fully expects us to live this way. He expects us not to get angry and have that hatred and rage towards someone. He expects us not to lust, not to think about others, not to let your mind go there. He totally expects that. This is the standard. And he's not just trying to prove a point either. He expects us to live this way. The rest of the book of Matthew is going to show us that no one can live perfectly. That our flesh will fail, but his spirit is strong in us. Jesus expects us to follow these commands. In fact, I would say that he demands that we follow these commands. And as we go through these demands one after another, we're going to start to see this pattern that's going to teach us more and more about Jesus. Last week, we acknowledged that he taught with authority. That he showed up, he said things that demanded we say, wait a minute, I've got to come to terms with who Jesus is and how he's addressing me here. He teaches with authority. And what we're going to see today is that we're going to learn a lot about the nature of sin, about what sin is and how it works. As we examine the Sermon on the Mount, we can learn a lot about sin and in turn learn a lot about ourselves and a lot about God. So before we talk too much about lust, and we'll talk about it as we go through here, but this whole sermon is not just a sermon specifically on this one sin, as much as it is about the nature of sin. So let's look at it from a little bit broader perspective. Why did Jesus teach on sin at all? Why did he show up and make demands? I mean, that word in and of itself, I think, is a bit offensive to a lot of us. It could be offensive to me to hear someone say, I make demands of you. Well, my first response is, who are you to make a demand of me? What gives you the right to make that demand? We looked at that last week with Jesus' authority, but Jesus could have just shown up and said, you know, he could have just shown up, lived a good life. He could have healed people, done a few miracles, wowed some people, kind of ticked off the right people and gone to the cross and then been there and done that. Why can't he just teach us to be good people? I mean, we know that kind of teaching. That's what most churches do teach, how to be a good person. Why couldn't Jesus do that? He could have limited his time here on earth to that, but he didn't. He didn't. He came teaching and teaching with authority. And what we'll see when we get to the end of Matthew 28, what he tells us in the Great Commission is to go and to teach everyone to observe all that he has commanded. Not just go and baptize, yes, he says that, but to teach everyone to observe all that he has commanded. Why is that so important? It was enough to show up and teach with authority, but now he has the audacity to demand that people follow him and listen to him and live the way that he says. It's a pretty audacious stance to take for someone. It's a pretty strong stance for him to take. That would be strong for me to stand up here and say, you have to live this way because I say so. If I ever stand up here and say, you have to live this way because I say so, you have my full permission. In fact, I would tell you, come and get me and say, knock it off. I don't care what you have to say. I stand here based on the authority of God's word, and that is all. I can't stand up here and say that. I can say that to my kids. You do this because I say so. But that's because of the authority that God has put in me as a father. So, it's enough to stand up and say, come follow me and live this way. Come follow me and live this way because your life will be better if you live this way. Like, that's another way I could do this, is say, come do this, follow this, listen to this, and your life will be better. And then my encouragement to you is basically you have the choice. Your life can be good, it can be bad. If you follow and listen to what I say, then you'll be happier. But Jesus doesn't just say that. Jesus goes a step further, okay? Jesus says you should follow him. Do you hear the difference in that? Not just that you can follow him, but you should follow him. Changing that one little thing to should means there's a moral component to this. There's a moral component to it. Jesus didn't hesitate here. He makes it clear that following him is a matter of right and wrong. Doing what he says is not a matter of preference or a matter of choosing what may be better for you. It's not an ethical system. It's a matter of what we're called to do. And it's a matter of sin and righteousness. It changes the game. What we can see from this is that we better know sin and we better know it well. We better know what we're dealing with. It doesn't do us much good to call ourselves followers of Jesus if we don't know what he says and what following him ought to look like, We have to understand what it is. There's a lot we could say here, some big picture things that we could really go into about what sin does and how sin works and all that. But I just want to look at just kind of the brass tacks, some practical things this morning. So let's see what we can get from this text about the nature of sin. One, sin comes from within. We've talked about this a lot. The book of Romans kind of beats us over the head with this, and that's what we did for a year and a half, about a year ago. So there's a lot. We've talked about this a lot. Jesus follows this pattern here. We talked about it last week. He follows this pattern in the Sermon on the Mount. He says, you've heard it said, but I say to you. You've heard it said, external command, but I say to you, it's about the heart. He's going to do this six different times, time and time again. He redefines it. He shows us that there's way more than what people had thought and what they had been taught. Jesus goes after the heart, the location of the sin. The location of the sin is not external. It is internal. The Pharisees had essentially taught that what was on the outside is what made us sinful. What Jesus teaches is that it's what's on the inside that makes us sinful. It's a totally different thing. It's not the sins that we do that make us sinners. It's the sin itself. Like we've said before, we aren't sinners because we sin. We sin because we're sinners. Right? It comes from within. The problem isn't our actions, but our heart that drives our actions. Why is murder and adultery a problem? Because our hearts are full of anger and lust. The external sins are the symptom. The internal sin is the disease. This is the first thing that we can see from this. Sin isn't something that can be externally managed by behavior modification. Right? If I were to tell you that I would give you $1 million if you could go the whole day, if you could go the whole day and not lose your temper one time. If I were to tell you I would give you $1 million, my guess is some of you guys could be remarkably controlled. But that's behavior modification. That's something externally modifying us. Our heart never changes. We talked about this with our kids too, right? We're not after well-behaved, good little citizens. We're after kids that love God. The same is true for us. This is what Jesus wants us to see. Sin is a deep-seated sickness of our souls that we cannot cleanse on our own. The second thing this teaches us is that sin is sneaky. Sin is sneaky. Jesus has shown us in these first two examples that simply by living the letter of the law, we do not fulfill the law. Simply by following the big sin, the external act, that doesn't cut it. That's what he's shown us here. The problem with that, the challenge in that, is that's how we tend to judge ourselves against others, right? It's how they act externally, how we act externally. If we feel like we can control what others see and what's in front of us and we see something in them that looks terrible because they act in a certain way, we think that if we judge ourselves by that standard, then what we see externally is enough. And then we judge ourselves based on whatever proportion we could adhere to. Does that make sense? Like, we'll find the highest level of obedience that we can obtain in a certain thing and then pretend that level is the good enough level. It's different for all of us depending on what sin it is and what you struggle with, but essentially, a little bit more self-control than you feel like you typically have means that you've been a little bit better. Or even more than that, we pretend that just resisting temptation is enough. Just resisting temptation is the end of the sin. But that's not the case. If it's internal, then we have to understand that resisting temptation is good. It's winning at the point of attack. That's a great place to start. But it's not the end. The battle goes much further. We can't just say, whew, I made it through the whole day and I didn't click on any of those websites. Thank goodness, I made it through the whole day and I didn't end up yelling at anybody. But we have to press further. We have to say, what is it in my heart that made me want to do that in the first place? That's where heart work happens. What is it that made my heart so inclined that I would pursue that sin in the first place, or that it would even be tempting to me? That's the next step. You know, spring is here, and I joked around about my yard and getting my yard mowed. It's looking pretty rough right now, but you know, we're remembering right now as everything blooms that allergies are completely a product of the fall, and that we all have to deal with this. You know, whenever I get a chance to mow, I know one of the things that's going to happen is I'm going to cut down a whole mess of dandelions. I'm going to cut down a whole bunch of them, which, just completely an aside, who decided those were weeds? They're yellow flowers. My kids pick them, and they give them to Emily, and they say, look, this is nice, and they give yellow flowers. Why could we have not just left it that way and said, look at all the pretty yellow flowers in my yard? Instead, we have to call them weeds and say that they're, I don't know, I don't understand. Why do we have to evolve past just calling them pretty yellow flowers? Anyways, what's going to happen is I'm going to mow over those. And what's going to happen is, because they are weeds and because they grow like crazy, is by the time I finish mowing, when I go back to the front yard, they're already going to be grown up again. That's the way that these things work, right? But for like 30 seconds, my yard is going to look pristine. It's going to look great because I've just chopped everything down, right? But why are those dandelions going to come back? Because I didn't kill them at the root. I just chopped the tops off. And this is the way sin works. Just chopping the top off is not enough. You got to get to the root of it. You can't think you've managed it. You can't manage sin. You have to uproot it. The third thing is that sin hijacks. Sin hijacks. Look at Jesus' instructions here. What does he tell the disciples to do? Pluck out their eye and cut off their hand. Pluck out their eye and cut off their hand. Over what? Over lust and adultery. In one example, in one little thing here, we can see a couple of different ways that things happen here. The first is through lust. Sexual desire is nothing to be ashamed from or to run from. It's not a problem. It is a good, healthy thing that God has given us. Much of the reason that our culture is falling apart when it comes to sexuality is because the church has been quiet for a long time and too afraid to talk about it and too afraid to admit this is something that God has given us, a beautiful gift. It is a central desire to us as humans. God has wired us in such a way that our sex drives are powerful things, and Satan has hijacked sex for his own means. This is how the vast majority of sin works. You take something that is good in and of itself, you take something that is good, and then you pervert it and you twist it. Something that's true and common for all of us, and then you twist it. This is what Satan has done. Take something good and corrupt it. Usually in small ways at the beginning that you'll miss unless you are very vigilant. I don't want to be clear whenever we're talking about lust here. This is something that goes for guys and for girls. Jesus uses the issue of a guy lusting over a woman, but it goes both ways. I've heard plenty of women express their heart palpitations over certain actors and certain things that they like to see, and I don't understand why it's okay for women to say that and not for men. It's not okay for men to say that, but I don't understand the double standard. But nonetheless, can I just tell you that, ladies, declaring your love for certain actors or certain people and how great they are and everything else, guys don't want to hear that mess. They don't want to hear it either, no more than you do, okay? I don't understand the double standard. This is an issue for both sexes. Does it look different? Absolutely it does. Does Satan use different tactics to attack men versus women? Yeah, absolutely. But lust is a human problem, not a male problem. Lust is lust, and it kills just the same. And that brings me to the fourth point about sin. Sin destroys. Sin destroys. So we see that it hijacks something that God intended to be good, but it goes even further. Jesus tells us to pluck out our eye and to cut off our hand. Those body parts were given to us by God to be used as instruments of righteousness. But instead, Jesus says it would be better to go without them than to let Satan corrupt your use of them. Sin causes things that God has given us to be destroyed, or at the very least, diminished, and lose their ability to do what God created them for in the first place. Let me say that again. Sin causes things that God has given us to be destroyed or diminished, and to lose their ability to do what they were created for in the first place. I mean, this example is so powerful that Jesus uses here. Just take lust, not even full-blown quote-unquote adultery, the letter of the law, but if a man gets hooked on internet pornography, it will destroy his marriage. It will. You guys that are in college, if you're struggling with that, I encourage you to fight that and put that to death in any way that you can. Getting married will not eliminate that. By far, the number one thing that I have met to counsel guys with since I have been a pastor is this issue, and it will destroy your marriage. Even before his wife finds out, or before your wife finds out, and she will, but even before she finds out, it will affect the marriage in 1,000 different ways. And that marriage will begin to crumble under the weight of that sin, and the husband will find himself unable to use marriage in the way that God intended. His marriage will no longer be the tool that God intended it to be. The eye doesn't work the way it's supposed to when you pluck it out. The hand doesn't work the way it's supposed to when you cut it off. And your marriage doesn't work the way it's supposed to when it's destroyed by pornography. We could go on and on and on and talk about 1,000 other things, because this is how sin works. Sin will rob you of everything that God intends for your life. Sin destroys your life, but even more than that, it destroys your soul. Satan's task is to kill, steal, and destroy. This is what Jesus tells us, and that includes this life and the one to come. Sin is not just some nasty habit. It's not a bad addiction. It's not a grouchy disposition. It is soul-killing, joy-robbing, and life-destroying. Sin is not something you play around with. So what do we do here? If sin is what destroys our lives, then what do we do with it? Jesus is clear that he has a remedy for us, and his remedy has implications for us. I'm going to go through these quickly. The first thing, radical is right. Radical is right. Implications of the nature of sin. The first, radical is right. Let me ask you, if I were to tell you as you walk out of this place today that if you went home, some sort of flesh-eating bacteria had invaded your house somewhere in the walls. I didn't know where, but I knew that there was this flesh-eating bacteria that was in your house. It's probably fine. I mean, after all, I think your mom probably lived with it, and it only affected her every now and then. It probably won't be too bad on your kids. I can't promise that, but for the most part, it probably won't be too bad. You've obviously learned to live with it because it's not new. Like, it's been there for a while, and you've figured out some way to live with it. But honestly, with advanced medicine, we've learned that this bacteria is eating you from the inside out. It's destroying everything in you, and it's going to alter your life expectancy, and certainly it's going to lower your quality of life. If I were to tell you that, what would you do? Would you go home? Would you say, yeah, you know what, thank you, I appreciate that, that's a good warning. I'm just gonna go on home and grab some lunch. Or would you do everything you could to eradicate it? Would you even go home at that point? Or would you go home, open the door, home sweet home, take a deep breath, honey, smell of death is in the air. Like, is it, which one is that going to be for you? Jesus' solution is radical. But here's what's crazy about Jesus' solution. It's not radical enough. It's not radical enough. This guy that Jesus is talking to still got a left hand. He's still got a left eye. Blind men can still lust. Jesus' point is not that destroying body parts will keep us from sinning. His point is that nothing should stop us from uprooting and destroying sin in our life. Sin is serious. And fighting it will take everything you've got. We've said before, be killing sin, or it will be killing you. The second implication is that we have to see that godliness and fighting sin has value in this life and in the one to come. Killing sin in this life is essential to finding true joy. The pleasures of sin are fleeting and will eventually lose their flavor. They are a temporary fix bought on credit, and you will have to pay. You're not gonna pay for a fix that you're eventually gonna have to pay on credit. You end up with bad credit and nothing to show for it. Sin is a ruined life and no joy. It's not a good trade. But what Jesus shows us is that lust and anger and honesty and all of these other things that he asks of us, they're not just about now, they're about eternity. Russell Crowe in Gladiator proudly and loudly proclaimed that what we do in life echoes in eternity. I don't think this is what he has in mind, but it's a fair point to make. Our sin is not just something small in the moment. It has eternal consequences. Please hear me this morning. Jesus is a man that speaks with authority because he has authority. He is our creator, our king, and our judge. We should submit to his authority, but none of us rightly and naturally do. We have all rebelled against it. Sin is true of all of us. No one escapes this. Everyone deals with this. Every single person. We must make peace with our lives, with our past, and with our sin. Our rebellion is against the King. You can deal with that, and you can make peace with that today. Today is the day that you can turn from this, that you can begin to deal with this, that you can turn your life and your heart to Christ, and he can change you. He can provide for you that ointment, that medicine that will heal you from the inside in, something you can never scrub clean enough. The stuff Jesus is laying out is impossibly hard. Impossibly. It is literally impossible in our own strength and our own power to follow what Jesus says here. We fail at this time and time again. But the beauty of Christianity is that he doesn't leave us in those failures. Instead, he says, what's impossible with man is possible with God. And this is the third thing, and I think maybe the most amazing. The third implication of knowing sin is that because we know sin, we can know the depth of God's love for us. Sin is black and it is ugly, it is painful and it is destructive. It is everything that Satan intends for it to be. But here's the beautiful thing. Satan can't stop God from saying, I will deliver you from this, and sin will then become the marker of how much he loves us. It is an amazing truth. And once we understand the depth and the destruction of sin, then we can begin to understand the beauty and the hope of the gospel. You see, Jesus' instruction was to cut off our hand and to pluck out our eye. But Jesus went further than that. He knew that we needed something far more radical to fight our sin. We needed someone to take our sin, to endure our punishment, to stand in our place, and to change our sin-natured hearts. He didn't just offer up a hand or an eye. He offered up his whole body on the cross. And that's why we can hear this message with hope. That's why we can hear the Sermon on the Mount with hope. Because he gave far more than a hand. He gave all. Sin kills. But Christ took that death, and Jesus now gives life. This morning, won't you turn from your sin? Won't you turn from that? If you're a Christian and you're struggling in that, understand that he has given you his Spirit so that you don't have to have the can't help it. That I can't help it. I've got to give in to this. He has given you his Spirit and you can fight against it. Are you tired of running? Are you exhausted from climbing that hill every day? Are you starting to realize that your self-righteousness is just another piece of your messed up heart? And the cross is for you. Come to Jesus and be changed this morning. Come to him and choose life. You can do that this morning. It's as simple as turning from your sin, responding to the call of the gospel. It's in Christ's name. Will you pray with me? Father, as we talk about sin and we talk about the true nature of our hearts, as we talk about what it means to follow you, we realize how short we fall. How prevalent sin is in our heart, and how desperately we need something outside of us to come in and heal us. So, Father, I ask that you will do that this morning. I pray that you will stir in the hearts of all of us here, encourage us, challenge us, motivate us to fight sin stronger than we ever have, and to know life, to know hope, to know peace. Father, thank you for the way you love us. It's in Christ's name we pray.